What is honor and how does it function? Well, for a lot of us, our experience of honor is limited to stuff like this.
Tell you the truth, this guy's starting to get on my nerves.
Worry not, Your Highness. I shall dispose of this feathered upstart. I challenge you to a duel. I accept.
That's from the Mel Brooks movie, Robin Hood, Men in Tights. And in that scene, Robin Hood answers the challenge for the duel by smacking his opponent in the face with a gauntlet made of chainmail. Honor is not just parodied in our culture. It also has a lot of negative connotations for people living in Western democracies. Things like duels that we just heard, feuds, honor killings seem to be kind of an affront to our values. But our guest today argues that we've lost a lot by ignoring the valuable lessons of honor cultures. In his new book, Why Honor Matters, philosopher Tamler Summers ranges from Greek tragedy to the National Hockey League in a discussion of how honor can help us lead more moral lives. Tamler Summers has a PhD in philosophy from Duke University and is currently an associate professor of philosophy at the University of Houston. And he also co-hosts a podcast called Very Bad Wizards. Tamler Summers, thanks for joining us this morning on the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, thank you for having me. I can't actually get over the weather forecast I just heard. I'm extremely jealous. We're having, even for Houston, a kind of heat wave right now that is kind of unbearable. So congratulations.
Well, we'll take it, at least for now. We often, in the summertime, have heat that is that will rival Houston's, although it's a dry heat, as they say. So, Tamler, we seem in our society to have a really complex relationship with the concept of honor. And I have to say, I found your book a real surprise. We either look at honor as a kind of a quaint artifact to be ridiculed, like the Mel Brooks clip that we just heard, or we have kind of a nostalgia for it. I think Downton Abbey was a good example of that. Or we kind of sort of have a fascination of how it plays out in maybe less savory ways, like The Sopranos or The Wire. But it's hard to find an example of honor in our daily lives as Americans. Where do we look for it?
Well, one place I think you find it is, or to look for it, is in the military. So I think most militaries, both in the United States and in other countries, operate according to some kind of honor code. And that's not surprising. Honor is often recruited as a value system when you need to motivate people to take great risks and when you need to motivate people to be loyal to each other, to have solidarity as a unit. And so I think you definitely find honor in the military. Sometimes it's explicit. I mean, we have the Medal of Honor, the Navy SEALs, the honor code in the Navy SEALs is laid out in some detail. I think you also find it in sports. You find it in hockey, most obviously, perhaps, because, again, it's kind of explicit. There are books written about hockey's honor code. You also find it in Major League Baseball, and a lot of the brawls and the various beanball feuds that they have in baseball that are pretty fascinating and operate according to a kind of a Byzantine set of unwritten principles that are shared amongst the players, but not always unanimously approved of. And I think that trickles down to all, sports in high school, sports in college, and some of the other sports too, probably the NBA a little less so. But so, I mean, those are some places to find it. I also think you can find it, and I hope we find more of it in just schools in general. not just school sports, but in schools throughout the country. I would hope to find it in the criminal justice system. One of the things that I think is modeled after the way honor culture has handled conflict is this new movement that I'm extremely excited about called restorative justice, which I think holds real promise in our efforts to engage in criminal justice reform.
Yeah, I really want to get into the criminal justice part of your argument, because that's a big part of your book a little bit later in the program today. There's some fascinating material there. But getting back to just the concept of honor, if readers pick up your book and they're looking for sort of an easy self-help book definition of honor, they're probably not going to find it. But you know, I'm kind of reminded of, I think it was Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart who famously said about obscenity, "I can't define it, but I know it when I see it." Can you at least sketch it out for us, what honor means to you?
Yeah, I mean, this has been a huge problem for me, especially as a philosopher, because it really is a hard concept to pin down. It's a messy concept. It can mean a lot of things in a lot of contexts, and that's philosophers in general aren't a fan of things that are messy. They like their concepts precise. But I can give some characteristic features of honor-oriented communities. So one thing that you find across the board, I would say, is a heightened concern for personal reputation and group reputation. So, I mean, everyone, we all care about our reputation to some degree, but that is heightened, and that becomes more important in honor culture. It's how the group sees you and how the larger world regards your group.
We're going to pick that up in, Tamler, we're going to pick that up in just a moment. We're talking with philosopher Tamler Summers about his new book, Why Honor Matters, here on the Jefferson Exchange. And we'll be back with more of the discussion after a short break. Back on today's Jefferson Exchange, I'm John Baxter in for Jeffrey Riley. Our discussion is about honor and codes of honor. We're talking with philosopher Tamler Summers about his new book, Why Honor Matters. And Tamler, I just violated the unwritten code of honor for radio talk show hosts and kind of interrupted you in mid-thought. We were in the process of defining honor, and you were talking about honor as being at least one of the concepts of honor as being finding your place within a group of people.
Yeah. So this heightened concern for your reputation and the reputation of your group. Hold on. This is my dog.
By the way, the dogs are credited at the end of Tamler Summers' book.
I think I violated about 8 different codes of honor just then. Along with that comes a heightened sensitivity to insult. Because insult, if you are insulted in an honor community, that tends to diminish your reputation. And so you will find in most honor cultures, people more likely to react aggressively when they're challenged, and especially challenged in a way that might reduce their status if they don't respond. And, you know, that has its good and its bad side for sure. But one thing I think that's good about that general way of looking at challenges is there is a strong conviction in honor cultures that you should handle your own conflicts yourself. You should stand up for yourself. And if somebody wrongs you in some way, then the right thing to do isn't to complain to some impartial third party, a stranger, an impartial authority of some kind, but to somehow handle it yourself, handle your business. That's kind of a code. That's like a motto, I think, that characterizes a lot of honor cultures. And again, this has its good and its bad side, but I think people often focus on the bad side, the violence, the cycles of violence, the blood feuds, the duels, although duels, I think, are a little more complicated than how they're portrayed, you know, in like the Mel Brooks clip that you played, or in many of the ways they're portrayed today. But you don't always have to handle your business with violence. There's mediation. There's just standing up for yourself and showing some heart, even if you can't physically defend yourself because of a power imbalance of some kind. And that's respected in honor cultures. And in many cases, it's expected of you that you will do that.
So in your book, you make the distinction between honor cultures and what most Western democratic cultures are, which you describe as dignity cultures. And I think that, at least if you look in the media, honor and dignity are sometimes used interchangeably, and they're not. You make a real distinction between those two concepts. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it's not exactly my distinction. It's a distinction that the sociologist Peter Berger, in a paper called On the Obsolescence of the Concept of Honor, I think, as far as I know, he introduced the distinction in that paper, and then people like Steven Pinker have picked up on it, contrasting cultures of honor with cultures of dignity. But I think, really briefly, the difference that I highlight is that dignity is founded in this idea of universal human rights. So dignity is something that you just have in virtue of being human, in virtue, depending on the theory that's supposed to justify it, in virtue of you being a rational agent of some kind. Whereas honor is something that you have to earn and something that you can increase or lose depending on how you behave. Dignity can't be touched. You have it. It can't be taken away. It doesn't matter what you do or how you behave. You always have the dignity that has to be respected by other people. And, you know, so I compare it in a little bit of a jibe to a participation trophy in schools, where you just get the trophy and you get it no matter whether you win or lose or even how you play the game. It doesn't matter. You have dignity. You can't increase it. You can't diminish it. And honor is something that you often have to compete for, fight for, and defend. And I fully recognize the value of the idea of dignity and the idea of human rights. But I also recognize the value of a concept or that you have to actually do something to earn, and that you're worried about preserving. And because I think that has tremendous motivational potential, and it's something that I think rights-based moralities, dignity cultures lack. Because those moralities are really more about telling you what not to do. And they have very few resources, both theoretical or motivational, to encourage people to behave in positively virtuous ways. All it really wants you to do is not infringe on other people's rights.
You know, something you mentioned there kind of resonated with me. We have a running race in our region that's held every year. It's very, very popular, very successful, but their motto is everyone's a winner. And I've always wondered how the person that crosses the finish line first feels about that.
Exactly.
And I'm also reminded of
the Incredibles, right? Where someone says everybody's special, and then the little kid says, which is another way of saying no one is.
And in professional cycling in Europe, which has its own strange honor code, people that come in second in a race are often referred to as the first loser. Let's get to sports for a moment. One of the anecdotes you relate, which I think is a really, really interesting illustration of an honor society in operation, and one that I think left a lot of Americans, to the extent they even paid attention, kind of scratching their heads, was the incident where Zinedine Zidane, the French soccer player, headbutted an Italian opponent in the 2006 World Cup final and was thrown from the game, which probably cost his country the championship. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so what happened, this is the World Cup final, and they're either in extra time or they're headed to extra time, and there's an Italian player who has been goading Zidane all game and saying things about his family, saying things, and finally went too far, said something about his sister, implying that she was promiscuous, and he headbutted. Zidane finally had enough. It was the straw that broke the camel's back. He headbutted him. He got a red card, and as you say, it likely cost than the championship. And the reaction afterwards was split, I would say, but split more against it wasn't an even split. I think the attitudes were more against Zidane, saying you can't do that, you have to rise above these provocations. But what was interesting in the days and weeks and months and now years that followed is you found that the neighborhoods that he came from, they took a great pride in what Zidane did, and that Zidane himself was, his greatness as a player was bound up in his loyalty to his family and to his roots and to his communities that he came up in. And I think popular opinion, I don't know if it's shifted tremendously, but there's certainly a groundswell of people who find what Zidane did to be honorable. At his ties, his connections were closer to his family and to his Algerian communities that he grew up in than they were to France as a whole. And so that required that he behave in that way. And I think people appreciated that. There was a big bronze statue of the headbutt, of Zidane's headbutt, that for a while was at the Pompidou in Paris. And so I and now he's the coach, I guess, of Real Madrid. I think people, even if today they don't agree with it, they respect it because they know what the source of it was, why he did it. And I think, this is one of the things that makes honor so interesting. It's not a no-brainer, right? I even for me, and if I was a French soccer fan, I might have been angry about it, but it is something that I think we have to take very seriously. And the things that I react against in the book are the knee-jerk reactions that it was so obvious that he did the wrong thing and that it was so irrational and that it was selfish. I mean, there was nothing selfish about it. He had no desire to get thrown out of a World Cup game. That I think is wrong-headed. But it's a fascinating dilemma, and it's a dilemma I think we find ourselves in a lot when we have competing loyalties. And maybe honor is pulling us in one direction and something else is pulling us in the other.
I was also interested in the reaction of the Italian player who was on the receiving end of Zidane's headbutt. Because
yes.
He kind of said, I sort of had it coming. And he obviously grew up in sort of an honor culture himself. And I laughed out loud when you mentioned the book, that somebody said, well, why did you talk about his sister instead of his mother? And he said, well, I'd never talk about his mother.
Yeah, he was actually annoyed. He said the one thing that he was upset about was that in some media reports, they said that he insulted his mother. And he said, I would never do that. That's completely out of bounds. No, I was just talking about his sister. being promiscuous, you know. And and so you see that everyone has ties to these honor cultures, and for him the boundary is just, that's where it stopped, mother. But you could say anything about the sister, that was fair play.
It's the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio. My guest is Tamler Summers, who is a professor of philosophy at the University of Houston, the author of a new book called Why Honor Matters. You can join the conversation this morning by calling us at 800-838-3760 or just shoot us an email at jx@jeffnet.org. And I want to thank my engineer for popping up a picture of that bronze of Zidane on my computer screen this morning. Tamler, you have admitted already, and you talk about in your book, that honor-based cultures certainly have a dark side, and many of them are violent. Many honor cultures oppress women. Have you had feminist critiques of this book yet?
No, I haven't yet. I wouldn't be surprised if they come. I also have been teaching this subject for a while, and I often find that women, once they learn about the complexity of the topic, they understand it. And I don't know, and not to gender essentialize or anything, but I think men sometimes get hung up on how irrational they think it is, and women are better, at least some of the women that I have taught are better able to appreciate the personal connections that come from being in an honor culture, and the value of loyalty, and the value of solidarity, and the value of courage. So, not yet, but I would fully understand it if the critiques come. And, you know, I think these days, a lot of people associate honor with something like honor killings, and which is just an extreme example of a concern for female purity that you find in many, though certainly by no means all, honor cultures. And that was something I really struggled with. You know, I talk about it in the book. I wrestled with, I was worried about, if I'm going to defend a value system, but there in many of these cultures, you have ideas about women that I think are immoral. That was a real problem. I think honor killings themselves, although they're horrific. So honor killings is when a young woman, a girl, is killed by a family member because she is suspected of having extramarital sex. That's a horrific practice. It's not a practice, I think, that is, you know, that comes out of the concept of honor itself. But the problem with honor, one of the problems with it, is it doesn't really, the codes will vary from culture to culture. And so if you have a larger morality system that has immoral attitudes about women, honor can sometimes be a more effective way of enforcing and entrenching them than some competing value system. And that's a real problem. And it's a problem at the extreme levels, but I think it's also a problem at some of the less extreme levels, where these attitudes are still there, even if they don't rise to the, you know, rare example of thinking that a woman needs to be killed for something like this. So this is one of the things that leads to my idea of honor needing to be contained. And it is a contained form of honor that I am trying to defend, and I acknowledge that the containment can't come from within the honor culture. The containment often has to come from the kinds of authorities that honor cultures tend to mistrust for interfering in their affairs.
And that sounds like that would be, in many cases, an instant and ongoing source of conflict.
Yeah, I think so. But it's not a it's a source of conflict that I think honor culture is just in virtue of being part of larger nations or larger communities are accustomed to having to navigate, and often they're able to navigate it successfully. I mean, I think sports is a great example. Sports, the containment that's just built in to sports doesn't come from the codes of sports themselves, but it's something that players are used to, players and coaches and officials, they understand, and they, you know, in some cases reluctantly, in other cases not reluctantly, embrace.
We're talking with philosopher Tamler Summers about honor, the concept of honor and honor cultures, as it's laid out in his new book, a fascinating book called Why Honor Matters. It's the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio. And we'll be back with more of our discussion with Tamler Summers after a short break. Final segment on today's edition of the Jefferson Exchange. I'm John Baxter. You can join the conversation by calling us at 800-838-3760 or at jx@jeffnet.org. We're talking with Tamler Summers, a philosopher and on the faculty of the philosophy department at the University of Houston, about his new book, Why Honor Matters. I have to admit that this book made me stretch my brain in a lot of different directions. And one area that I thought was really particularly challenging and fascinating was early on in the book, where you talk about America's obsession with personal safety and linking that to the fact that we're not an honor-based society. And it starts with you saying, hey, I don't ever use a bicycle helmet. Help us out with that.
Yeah, I mean, part of that is a joke, but really only part of it. I think that if you look at how we grew up as kids, no kid wore a bicycle helmet, and certainly no adults wore bicycle helmets. And now, especially in the Northeast, it's bad. I'm winning this war, but especially in the Northeast and in parts of California, you get lectured if you're not wearing a bicycle helmet because of the tiny negligible risk of head injury that you might get in a fall, which is truly negligible. And meanwhile, wearing a helmet is annoying. It might even make you not want to take your bike out. So why are we doing this to our kids? Why are we doing this to ourselves? To me, it is emblematic of a more widespread problem in American society, which is that we have become extremely risk averse. We want to optimize our chances of living, which of course doesn't sound bad when you say it like that, but actually, you know, I think a good and flourishing life requires that we take some risks. And I think a moral life, maybe more importantly, requires that we take some risk. And I think, you know, a few of the examples that I use, like our attitude towards Syrian refugees. So after the attack in France, our politicians were tripping over themselves saying how we can't allow more Syrian refugees into America because of, again, the infinitesimal chance that one of them will lead some homegrown terrorist organization or something like that. These are people who desperately needed our help. These are people who needed our help from the very people that we were fighting, ISIS. And it was the most cowardly display that I had seen in the politicians and in many segments of American society. And it seemed like we lacked the rhetoric to address it. I mean, here in Texas, we're supposed to be this swashbuckling state, and Greg Abbott, our governor, and Ted Cruz, they were immediately closing our borders to refugees. How is nobody calling them out for being huge cowards and calling anybody who supports their policies for being huge cowards, that you're not willing to run the tiny, tiny little risk? And it's not even, like, it's so negligible, and help people who desperately need it, and be hospitable, something that honor cultures throughout the world are famous for, their hospitality. This is a case where being hospitable wasn't just a nice thing to do. It was morally required, I think, in this area. But this is what happens when you just try to reduce the chances of anything bad happening to such a small degree that moral considerations like that just take a back seat. And, you know, I contrast that with the movie and the book Lone Survivor, Marcus Luttrell. He was taken in by a tribe, a Pashtun tribe, that literally risked their lives. They took a serious risk of their lives to protect him from the Taliban because of their codes of hospitality. And then there was us and what we were, Chris Christie saying he was going to not accept 3-year-old Syrian orphans in New Jersey. And it just struck me as utterly unacceptable. And I think these attitudes have spread widely. I think police militarization is another consequence of this risk aversion. And I think mass incarceration, you know, a lot of the rise in the prison population came from the rise in violent crimes that you saw in the 70s. It was a response to that, the 70s and 80s. And now, now we have the highest prison population in our history, in the world. To really address that problem, one of the things that surprised me is it's not just the drug war, right? You could just let out everybody who's there for marijuana crimes, or even just nonviolent drug crimes. It would just be a drop in the bucket for reducing the prison population. So I think this has, you know, sometimes it may seem less serious, like bicycle helmets or car seats that take 10 minutes to strap your kid in, but sometimes it actually has deep moral implications. And yeah, I want us to embrace risk a little bit more than we currently are as a society.
Well, that will lead us into a conversation about the criminal justice system, but I want to go to a call first. This is Cynthia in Talent. Good morning. You're on the Exchange.
Great. Yeah. We need philosophy, definitely, and this is a really good example of it for a more nuanced and wise discussion. But I am concerned, I am a feminist, at how much honor has been used, you know, to justify wars, killings, and it's generally kind of, you know, tied up with male ego. And I just think it's pretty dark and pretty dangerous, and yet there is this kind of opportunity to talk about, you know, what is the true moral compass. And so I appreciate the conversation. I just wondered if you wanted to comment on the male power issue. Thank you.
Back on the line right now, and I will do my best to relate that question to you. Tamler, thanks for joining us again. We lost your call for a moment. We had a call from Cynthia and Talent who wanted you to comment on the relationship between honor and ego, especially male ego.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think honor can sometimes have a detrimental effect on people in neighborhoods where they feel like they have to prove a reputation for toughness or a reputation for aggression. Now, sometimes you just have to prove that in order to be left alone. And that's not Honor's fault. That's just the conditions of that environment. But sometimes it can encourage, again, this is one of the examples where I think Honor needs to be contained. It can encourage men to try to dominate so that they'll be the highest, you know, they'll have the highest status of people in that honor community. And depending on the codes of the community, that can mean engaging in acts of violence, engaging in acts that I'd consider immoral. So, yeah, it's an example because that can lead to escalating violence, cycles of violence, long-running feuds. It's an example where I think that threat of escalation needs to be contained. And what's considered acceptable and honorable needs to be contained. And in the book, I do try to give some examples of how people today are trying to navigate that in communities, impoverished communities and impoverished neighborhoods in the country.
And you also bring in the restorative justice movement. And in the book, you examine in great detail the moral and intellectual underpinnings of our current criminal justice system. And you have in a single page, a pretty clear comparison between how we administer justice and then how it would be administered ideally under an honor-based system. You talk about revenge versus retribution, but you list three major ways that our system differs from an honor system. We don't have a lot of time left, but can you describe those three ways that they differ?
So I'm trying to get what you're referring to. I can say this, that because I don't remember that section of the book exactly, the three ways that you're talking about, but I can tell you some ways in which they differ. We treat once an offense turns from a civil offense to a criminal offense, we then treat the criminal offense as an offense against the state, not an offense against a particular victim, which is why when you'll have a defendant, it'll be the defendant versus the people or defendant versus the state of New York or whatever. So honor cultures always view offenses, whether they're criminal or civil or, you know, insults, as that's a conflict between two people. It doesn't, you know, if I get mugged, the state of Texas didn't get mugged. I got mugged. I'm the victim. And so in an honor culture, then I would be a part of trying to make that conflict right. Whereas in our system, I really have very little to do with how that case turns out. That is something that an attorney for the state and an attorney for the person who assaulted me, they will do battle in court to try to come up with an appropriate outcome, a just outcome according to the laws. Now, of course, in practice, that never quite works out, especially for poor people. But at least in theory, that's the idea. And even in theory, honor cultures never see conflicts like that. They see conflicts as primarily between the people who are affected by it. But the person who wronged, the person who was wronged, and maybe the relevant community members, the people who are affected by the offense. And they get together and try to work it out. They try to resolve it, try to make it right. And there is a movement that is modeled on this that has begun to spread widely within the schools for school discipline, and also in some cases in the United States in juvenile courts, but only in exceptional cases in adult criminal courts. But that it borrows from exactly those principles, that this is, it's not a conflict against the state when somebody is harmed. It's a conflict to that person. And so we need to get in a session where that person has a say, the person, the victim, has a say in how the conflict is resolved. And there's some beautiful outcomes that can result from approaching conflicts in this way. But there is a lot of theoretical and practical obstacles to implementing it. It can be done. You see it in cases, especially in Australia and New Zealand. But it's something that I think I'd buy stock in this. I think this is the wave of the future. It already is making serious advances in schools and juvenile courts, and I think people will turn to it. Hopefully, I'm hopeful that people will turn to it in harder cases and adult criminal court cases as well, because when you actually encounter it, it seems there's something that seems so right about it and so just about it.
And that would be the restorative justice movement. We've been talking with Tamler Summers. He is an associate professor of philosophy at the University of Houston. You can also check out his podcast. It's called Very Bad Wizards. I've listened to it. It is very entertaining. And Tamler Summers is the author of a new book, Why Honor Matters. Very thought-provoking stuff. Thank you for joining us on The Exchange.